Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs. And in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heated, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butz and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but Don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play, he worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As far as I know here, you're in trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out on the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory, and that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it, and I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul wrote, I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth has laid up in me. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. And David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross. I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdraw thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man, with two nails in his hand, split history in half, B.C. and A.D. And what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win, because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him, and talk with him, and work with them and stick together and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They want to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
All right, so today in the federal courts of Washington, D.C., the Cherokee Nation was dealt a huge blow in their fight against the freedmen. Now, for those of you that don't know, freedmen are the descendants of slaves and free black people that were living on Cherokee land in 1866. And in 2007, the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, this is a western band of Cherokee, by the way, Osceo, for those of you in Cherokee Nation, they voted to, I guess that I'm used to saying disenroll, so they chose to disenroll or to take the citizenship of 3,000 descendants of free blacks and former slaves of Cherokee Nation members and take away their citizenship. Now we were fooling. Nope, you didn't read the treaties well enough. You didn't read the treaties word for word, and we're voting to revoke your citizenship. Those freedmen took the the Cherokee Nation to court. I'm Comanche, so I keep wanting to say Comanche, but this is Cherokee we're talking about, not my tribe, Cherokee tribe. And so those freedmen sued. Now, to go back and just do a little bit of history on the Cherokee belonged to the five civilized tribes. And the five civilized tribes were in the southern region of America. They were the Choctaws, the Creek, the Seminole, the Chickasaws, and the Cherokee. And the reason why they were considered civilized tribes was because they were assimilating into white culture. They owned land. They owned property. They were dressing as white people. They had converted to Christianity. So they were assimilating into white culture. And one of the things that they were assimilated into is the farming styles of the whites, which included slaves. So they were purchasing slaves. And John Ross was one of the biggest slave holders in the Cherokee Nation. And John Ross took the federal government to court when they were trying to remove the five civilized tribes out into Oklahoma. And he won. He took it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he won the ruling that they had the right to their land and their property and able to stay there. And President Andrew Jackson said, good luck enforcing the judgment. You got a judgment in your favor. Good luck enforcing it. I have the military, and you're going to be escorted off of your property. With those tribes going on what is now called the Trail of Tears, were also their slaves. That's something they don't talk about a lot. In fact, I even had a Cherokee person, Eastern Band Cherokee person, and maybe they were talking about the Eastern Band, actually tried to tell me that there weren't Native Americans fighting for the Confederacy, and that there weren't any Native Americans that owned slaves, when there is so much evidence that they did. And this person claimed to know their history, which is really scary, because they obviously didn't. Now, the Eastern Band Cherokee in North Carolina, they didn't go to Oklahoma. They resisted. They stayed. And so the Oklahoma has, the Cherokee band has broken up into different bands. Those bands were even more divided during the Civil War. Now, during the Civil War, the five civilized tribes broke up. The Choctaw and the Chickasaws were solidly Confederate. The Creek and the Seminole were solidly Union. The Cherokee had internal strife as to which side they were going to go to, and the majority went with Stan Waddy, their chief, one of their chiefs, into the Confederacy, and Stan Waddy actually became a Confederate general. He was actually winning a lot of battles too. And a minority of the tribe went to the Union. So in 1866, the reason why it took so long to free the slaves of the five civilized tribes, or especially the Chickasaw, Cherokee, and Choctaws, is because these are sovereign nations within the United States. They fall under the executive branch of government, the federal government. And being a sovereign nation, Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had no influence at all under these sovereign nations that are the different Indian tribes. So in 1866, there's a treaty that is signed, and one day all of the enslaved people that belonged to Cherokees and Choctaws and Chickasaws were all free. They woke up one morning, had breakfast, and their master said, you're free. Go pick out a tract of land, go farm it, have a happy life. You have the same rights and privileges as a Cherokee. You're entitled to land. Go have a happy life. Go live in peace. Some of them, there wasn't a Jim Crow era or a Klan version of any of the freed Indian tribes. It was just one day you were free and you're equal with the same rights and privileges we have. So you can enter into public office, you can be law enforcement, you can vote, you can, be outlaws if you want. I mean, they were equal. It was just one day, okay, you're free, good. And so that's the treaty that the freedmen are citing in their argument, is the Treaty of 1866. The Cherokee Nation, from what I read, is citing the Act of April 26, 1906, which is another treaty which supersedes the 1806 treaty, makes it null and void. And what that treaty says is that as of December 1st, 1905, no person shall be enrolled as a citizen No person shall be enrolled as a citizen or a freedman. Freedman is what they call the former slaves. So they're differentiating whether or not someone could be enrolled as a free citizen or a freedman of the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, or Seminole nations. So they're differentiating, and this is very important because it's coming down as to whether or not these treaties spelled out the freedmen as citizens of the nation. In Section 3 of the Act of April 26, 1906, it states Cherokee freedmen shall include only such persons as African descent, either free colored, remember I said free black people living on the Cherokee Nation land. So Cherokee freedmen shall include only such persons as African descent, either free colored or slaves of Cherokee citizens and their descendants. Whoever actually personally bona fide, who were actually personally bona fide residents of the Cherokee Nation, so residents of the Cherokee Nation, not citizens, residents of the Cherokee Nation, August 11, 1866, or who returned and established residence in the Cherokee Nation on or before February 11, 1867. So in 1906, they're not taking new freedmen or new enrollments as citizens. The only way that I know that you can be enrolled as a citizen in any Native American tribe today is you have to prove blood quantum. You have to have a relative. You have to say, this is, I am a descendant of this person in this tribe, which makes my blood quantum an eighth, a quarter, whatever. And different tribes have different laws or rules as to how much blood quantum you need to be a citizen of that tribe. And August 22nd, 2007, the Cherokee Nation voted to decide who they were going to allow citizenship to and decided that these freedmen did not qualify for citizenship in the tribe. And so they kicked those 3,000 people off of the citizenship. And the Diane Hammonds, the Attorney General for the Cherokee Nation, her argument is if you look at both the 1866 treaty and the 1906 treaty, that nowhere in those treaties does it spell out that freedmen were actually citizens of the Cherokee Nation, only that they had the same rights and privileges. What the difference is, I don't know, maybe it means that they can't vote in, you know, tribal council, vote for the chiefs. But what they're trying to argue is that a tribe in its sovereignty should have the ability to determine who, what the rules are to be a citizen of their tribe. So they're arguing that this violates their sovereignty. And they're pointing to the Dawes rules, telling the freedmen if they want citizenship in the tribe, that they need to find a relative on the Dawes rules. The freedmen are arguing about the Dawes rules that when the government went around registering Cherokees on the Dawes rules, that they looked at the person they were registering and they didn't ask them if they had Cherokee blood. They looked at the person and wrote down whether they were black or Cherokee on the roll. So they're saying that there's not a definitive way to prove blood relation because no one was ever asked what their blood relation was to members in the Cherokee Nation when they were signing up for the Dawes rolls. And so that's their argument. I'm not really sure who's right in this. So I'm presenting the facts. Comment, let me know what you think. I probably do plan to get a lot of hate from those Native American people who want to deny that there were slaves held by tribes and that there were Indian nations that fought for the Confederacy, but it's documented, well-known history. So, you know, you can't refute that. But let me know in the comments what you think. I normally don't do videos on nights that I work because I'm really tired. But this is big news in Indian country because this could also open up other lawsuits to those civilized tribes. And there were not tribes that were innocent in the slave trade. I'm Comanche. We trafficked humans to the Mexicans. So, you know, not every tribe has clean hands. And Claude Anderson is an activist who is trying to get reparations from Native American tribes, because by having citizenship in tribes, you are tax exempt. You get free tuition into college. You get, they're fighting for their 160 acres of land. You know, you can have a casino. So, you know, they want those reparations too. And he's actually calling it reparations from Native tribes. So I'm not sure if he's going after just the five civilized tribes or if he's trying to go after every tribe. But I think that this opens up other tribes to lawsuits. And if I know the Cherokee Nation, they will take this all the way up to the Supreme Court. Whether the Supreme Court will hear it or not is another story, but please, again, let me know what you think. I don't have a position in this. I think if people are living thinking that they're citizens of a nation, you should not rip citizenship from them. But, you know, I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but I think if you have lived your entire life believing that you are a citizen of a nation, I just don't think it should be ripped away from you. But I'm not a member of the Comanche, or I'm sorry, I'm not a member of the Cherokee Nation. So again, comment. Have a good night.
All right, today we're just going to briefly mention Florida rooms and Florida houses. That's something that we're into offline here. But let me comment on this last audio I played. The narrator, who I don't know, so I don't know her background and how much research he did, and I'm a fan of Claude Anderson, and I don't know everything he said or done or written or whatever, but I can say this. Many reparations has already been paid out in many parts of Oklahoma, and this is documented. You take some of the black townships, because they had a lot of black townships in Oklahoma, and Texas had probably more than anybody else. But let's go with Oklahoma, because I know about that boots on the ground myself. I've got a house in a black township in Oklahoma for the last few years. Some blacks, and one notable one is Sarah Rector, who by skin tone, we would classify her today in 2023 going into 2024 as a black. Okay. Now, Sarah Rector, who was an oil tycoon from age 12, all right, oil baron at age 12, the black townships that were formed, now there's about 13 or 15 black municipalities in Oklahoma right now. Now, those are municipal townships. There are also black communities or towns that are unincorporated that are basically not on the one of them is Blackjack, Oklahoma, which is literally sandwiched right next door to Taft, Oklahoma. Taft, Oklahoma is has a municipal charter. It's over 100 years old. You can look it up online. Okay. However, Blackjack, Oklahoma, which is just as, is there just like Taft, Oklahoma. All right.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, I got booted out, but I'm back in. Now, as I was stating, reparations have, not for all black folk, but for quite a few over 100 years ago, were paid out. Now, I'm using the state of Oklahoma in this example. What I'm saying is documented. In particular, if you put connect the dots. All right. You have people like Sarah Rector, who if you look at a pictures or pictures of Sarah Rector, you will see what we classify today in 2023 going into 2024 as black or African-American. She was also Native American. Legally speaking, she was Native American. All right. She was allotted when she was 12 years old, anywhere from 80 to like 160 acres of land. And I'm going to look that up right now. Now, by her and others, I'm looking it up right now. Yeah. By her and others getting their land and land allotments in a form of 80 acres to 160 acres on average, okay, that was de facto reparations. 619-768-2945 if you disagree with that. On her land allotment, I don't know whether it was 80 acres or 160 acres, and her childhood home in Taft, Oklahoma, every time I've driven past her house several times. Several times. Because Taft ain't so big anyway. You can walk to town in no time at all. What some black folk did, or what some Native Americans slash black folk, what we call today African Americans or black folk, they would consider themselves Native Americans. What some of them, quite a few of them actually, did back then was they said, you know what, let's take your 80 acres, let's take my 160 acres, and let's form our own town. And that's how a lot of these black townships, not only in Oklahoma, but we're talking about Oklahoma right now, that's how they came into being. So they leverage, and like I say, I consider that reparations. They got, like I say, they got their land allotments of 80 to 160 acres. And then they practice cooperative economics and form their own town. All right, let's see. Now, I'm looking here on Wikipedia. I'm trying to get the exact amount of wealth. And some of their lands had, you know, oil on it. Sarah Rector was one of those people that she had oil on her land. Now, Sarah wasn't the only one in the Rector family because, you know, her dad had land too, and he had other children. So hold on, let's read this right here. Sarah Rector, she was a Cree freedman. All right, Sarah's father, Sarah's father, Joseph, was the son of John Rector, and John Rector was a Cree freedman. All right, John Rector's father, Benjamin McQueen, was enslaved by Riley Grayson, who was a Cree Indian. And there's a town in Oklahoma called Grayson, all right, black township. John Rector's mother, Molly McQueen, was a Muscogee, part of this Muscogee tribe, who fought with the in the Seminole Wars and split with the tribe, moving his followers to Kansas. Sarah Rector was allotted 159.14 acres, which is 64 hectares of land. Now, that was her reparations. That was her reparations. Okay. Some people talk about, well, we didn't get our 40 acres. She got, look at the picture, and she wasn't an isolated incident. She wasn't an outlier. There were several, probably over 1,000. No, a lot more than that, probably, that got land allotments like that. All right. I consider that reparations. All right. Now, the mandatory step in the process of integration of Indian Territory with Oklahoma Territory to form what is now the state of Oklahoma, or oil striking wealth. The parcel allotted to Sarah Rector was located in Glenpool, which is 60 miles from where she and her family lived, which was Taft, Oklahoma, okay, and Blackjack, because Blackjack and Taft, they're right there together, all right? But one's incorporated, one has not incorporated at all, all right? It's considered, it was considered inferior and fertile soil, not suitable for farming, with better land being reserved for white settlers and members of the tribe. The family lived simply, but not in poverty. However, the $30 annual property tax on Sarah's property was in such burden that her father petitioned Muskogee County Court to sell the land. His petition was denied because certain restrictions placed on the land, so he was required to continue to pay taxes. Thank God for that. All right. To help cover the expenses on February 1911, okay, Joseph Rector leased Sarah's parcel to the Standard Oil Company. In 1913, an independent oil driller, B.B. Jones, drilled a well on the property that produced a gusher that began to bring in 2,500 barrels of oil a day. Rector began to receive daily income of $300 from this strike. That's good money today, $300 a day. Okay, matter of fact, now let's... I have an inflation calculator on my phone. So let's do the math here. $300, okay, and 1911, what would that be? All right, in today's dollars, that's $9,453.85. So essentially, now this is the booster rockets of reparations. And Sarah Rector wasn't only, so Sarah Rector was receiving over $9,000 a day. It's $300 back then, but in today's dollars due to inflation, imagine if you were getting $9,453.85 paycheck on a daily basis, right now today. So not only did she get, she and others who looked like her, reparations, and this is 1911 when this was happening. Okay. The rocket boost on that was over $9,000 a day revenue. And she still owned the land because she just leased it. Or dad just leased it for it because she was just 12 years old. So that's where I disagree with Claude Anderson on. I don't know the whole context of what he's talking about, but there's a lot. Once again, let's look at the forms of reparations. Okay, number one, they got land allotments. She got 64 hectares. She got 159.14 acres. So she got at 12. So that's one way that she and many others like her got reparations. And we're talking about thousands of people. This wasn't one or 200 people. Number two, land, some of them decided, you know what, let's practice group economics. Let's take your 160 acres. Let's take my 80 acres. Let's take whatever acres you got, and let's form our own town. Let's get a municipal charter. Let's have our own town and make up our own rules, have our own city councilman, have our own mayor, have our own democracy. So I would call that reparations, another form of reparations. This is over 100 years ago. Number three, some of them became oil tycoons, oil barons, like Sarah Rector. She wasn't the only one. All right. And she was making the equivalent of over $9,000 a day. Now, I'm going to just round that down to $9,000. I'm going to just take it out. I'm just doing business days, 20 business days out of a month. That's $180,000 a month income. $2,160,000 a year income, daily paychecks. That's what Sarah Rector and many others that look like her got over 100 years ago. Now, when we bring this forward to 2023 going into 2024. They already got paid. You also have many people that, I mean, like, I'll take my family. On my mother's side of the family, we've got 88 acres as a family. Nobody's done anything with it ever. You know, we got one family, a couple of family members living on it. Got sugarcane all over the place. From what I understand, you know, oil companies, I mean, I don't know, 60, 70 years ago, came to my great-grandmother, Grandma Lizzie, as we call her today, trying to get permission to drill, because this is right on the Gulf in Louisiana. But I never heard anything coming of it. And various family members just keep the property taxes going because it's 88 acres of land. So me, myself, I believe in do-it-yourself reparations because on a family level, well, hey, as a family, collectively, we got 88 acres. If we would just develop a little small part of it, all of us could be in my particularly blood-related family. All of us could be set for life. But for some reason, they're not thinking that way. So then I'm looking at, well, what can I do for myself? Because today with social, well, with the Internet and the Internet connection, you know, I can go to the public library and book on land, or I can go out into the country and find me a piece of parcel of land. I can put together my own 40 acres. I'm up to 14 and some change. 14 and some change right now. I've got a ways to go because my thing is natural resources. I would like to have legal access to a billion gallons. I might change that to liters, but I want to have access to a billion gallons of water, groundwater. I already know stuff is going to fall off from the sky. That's how I measure wealth. That my number one metric for wealth measuring is not dollars, but natural resources. Because all you use the dollars and pesos and euros for and rubles, which is all issued by man-made governments. You use that basis to purchase ultimately natural resources or products that come from natural resources like furniture and all sorts of stuff, clothes, you know, all that. So that's me. Once I reach that goal, I mean, of a billion gallons, I got to figure, I'm going to think that out there. Do I want a billion gallons or a billion liters? Okay, of groundwater. That's my goal. You don't hear anybody talk about that. You don't hear about anybody measuring wealth that way. There's some people that do, but I haven't heard anybody voice it. Because I figure I got I don't buy water now. Where I'm at. I'm good. You know, I'm sitting on enough, literally right now, enough groundwater with a well, where I can, everybody in the subdivision can benefit from it. But where I'm at, there's no big, I mean, because I got a well, everybody I'm surrounded by, neighbors, we all have wells. But anyway, that's my take on Dr. Claude. I mean, like I say, I don't know the context that he was talking about, but you do have a number of, and another thing is, when I was out, because there's another black township that's Summit, Oklahoma. Last time I was through there, I went to Summit. And Summit was put together the same way where, you know, you got so many acres, I got so many acres, and they put their acres together and they formed a town of, you got a municipal charter for Summit, Oklahoma. Now, right near Summit and Tab, there's a casino, because all this is in Muskogee County, Oklahoma. And I don't gamble anything, but I've never gone inside a casino. So, I said, well, you know, I knew they had a restaurant inside of there. And so I went in there to, you know, have lunch or brunch in this case. Man, I ordered a pancake meal. Man, if you ever go to the Oklahoma, the casino in Muskogee, and go in there with two or three, maybe four people, they served me two pancakes that were the size of, like, platters. I couldn't even eat it all. Couldn't even eat it, and I had an empty stomach. I was hungry. I couldn't even get through half of it. But you see the diversity when it comes to skin tone, because they had black folk working in there, they had brown people working in there, they had white people working in there, and the way those jobs are distributed within the tribe. Because they hire people from within the tribe first and foremost. And then the profits, you know, are divvied up among the people that don't even work there, because that's their form of Social Security and whatnot. So the reparations people, what context are we talking about? Because, matter of fact, let me look it up now. Let's see. What I saw boots on the ground, you're not going to read it in the book. At least I haven't run across it in the book. Let's see. Number of people on the Dawes Rolls, and I need to do a little research on that. All right, the rolls contain more than 101,000 names between 1898 and 1914, primarily from 1899 to 1906. All right. So, that's quite a few people. Quite a few people. So, for the reparations people, like I said, I don't know what metrics that they're using, but like I say, for the state of Oklahoma at least, okay, because you at the time of Black Wall Street, which was a neighborhood within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, there were 50 black municipalities in the state of Oklahoma. Now, there were probably just as many as incorporated communities. Okay. There were probably no less than 50 additional unincorporated communities, unincorporated townships in the state of Oklahoma, and some of those towns still exist to this day. So when we look at Black Wall Street, let's put this thing in context. Okay, black folks, and Black Wall Street happened in 1921. So black folks, a number of them, enough to start 100 townships in Oklahoma, okay, were formed and doing well during the year of 1921. However, the neighborhood of the Greenwood neighborhood, which is located, which is known as Black Wall Street today, was there's only one building standing there, one or two buildings standing there. Well, maybe the guy who organized the community of Black Wall Street, maybe. I don't know him. He's no longer living. Can't judge him. He was an entrepreneur and a good entrepreneur at that. But he did the opposite of what those 100 other communities, because those other 100 communities in the state of Oklahoma have never experienced racial violence. Why? They moved to, and here's my primary wealth metrics. Number one, at least for me, is natural resources. Number two is social capital. And that's how they formed these towns, these municipalities and unincorporated towns. They did it through social capital, just like the Amish and the Mennonites and the Hutterites do today. Number three, factories. Now, a factory is a place. It could be a bedroom. It could be a kitchen table. It could be, we're going to talk about Florida rooms here momentarily. It could be your backyard, a place where you make things. You make things and you sell it. You can make an apple pie and sell it. That's manufacturing. You can make a meatloaf dinner and sell it. I consider that manufacturing. You can make a bed. You can make furniture. You can make a tiny house. You can make a big house. Anything that you make and sell, I consider, where the place where you do it, I consider that a factory. I consider that that's one of my wealth metrics. Okay. Number four wealth metric for me, geography. The 100 or so black townships and communities in the state of Oklahoma that existed at the same time as the neighborhood of Black Wall Street, they set up camp in areas that on a geographical level was safe and quiet and hostile where they can sleep at night. Or if need be, they can set themselves up geographically where they can defend themselves. Once again, the Greenwood neighborhood, which was within hostile territory at the time in the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was bound to happen. And let's look at the facts. How come you have all these other black townships in Oklahoma that were townships now with resources, with wealthy people? See, Black Wall Street wasn't the only place in Oklahoma where you had wealthy black people. There were wealthy black people in 100 black townships in the state of Oklahoma, but nobody talks about that. A lot of people come from the victim aspect. They ignore the 100 other communities and focus in on just the one. Well, what did the one do that the 99 others that never got affected didn't do? Well, the geography. So, once again, Black Wall Street was not the only community of black folks that were wealthy in the state of Oklahoma. But the way they run the narrative today is like they were the only community of wealthy black folks. No, they had black folks, wealthy black folks in all those little towns. And matter of fact, the towns that still exist, the municipalities that still exist, and the unincorporated, they can treat, some of them have lived, had that, the houses, the family house, the ancestral house, as I like to call it, is over 100 years old. All right, anyway, I'm off my soapbox with that. Okay, so offline, we're organizing a community of people, and I'm sending out today membership qualifications, because we have right now two levels of membership. Actually three, but two active. And we had to reboot or put structure to our basic membership offline was free. So we're still going to have it free, but now they're going to have to take some action steps because it's a probationary free. So I'll be sending that out today, and we'll probably announce our levels of membership because we've got two. Like, one's paid, and the paid membership is, for all practical, it's $5,000. Okay. But, like I say, that's what it is now. But, like I say, we do have a boots on the ground membership. You don't need one red cent to participate in it. But number one, you've got to show up to our boots on the ground location, which is here in Florida. That's number one. Number two, you got to participate. You got to show up, sign up, and participate in an actual build. Number one, you just can't do it that one day. You've got to do it at least four times within a year. All right. Now, on your fifth time, okay, then you've got to be recommended by two of our board members to apply, so you can apply for the next level of membership. And you could get turned down. Now, all this time, you haven't put in one red penny, but we had to restructure to keep out the peanut gallery. We had to keep out the peanut gallery. So it's all right. We're not going to charge them anything. This is on the boots on the ground because we have another level that was paid. That's frozen right now. That nobody can even get into that. Who's ever in it right now is in it. It's a small group of people, and we're going to keep – it's under 10 people. So we're going for quality over quantity. So we're sending out a note today to people who came out to see us in Jacksonville. And, all right, you can still come to these. It's one event that they can come to. One event that they can come to, we might throw in another freebie perk that'll be available online in the form of a class that they need to take. But the bottom line is they have to show up to our facility here in Florida. They got to show up in person. Once they show up, they have a probationary membership, all right? And they've got to show up and participate at least three more times within a 12-month period of time. Now, we'll be having something, activities going on every month. If they show up 4 months in a row, all right, they get off the probationary status, but then they've got to be recommended by at least two of our board members. If they don't get recommended, they can't get in. Then let's say they get recommended, they fill out the application, and then they get approved. Okay, then they've got to pay an initiation fee plus dues. Now, initiation fee, you can get it all in on that, or the initiation fee plus, if you need to, you can split your dues up quarterly, twice a year, or monthly. Quality over quantity. All right. And one of the projects, two of the projects that we're going to be working on are Florida rooms and Florida houses. Okay. Florida rooms and Florida houses. This week, I'll be doing a video on both Florida rooms. I have access to a Florida room right where I'm at right now. I use that as my de facto factory, indoor factory. But we're also going to be talking about Florida houses. Florida house is based off a Florida room. And you can go online and look at this. Type in Florida rooms and you'll get a look at what they look like. More likely you've seen them and whatnot. And detached Florida rooms and Florida houses. So, okay, what time do we have here? All right, I don't want to knock off early. I'm not going to knock off early, so. Let's go to Solar Cabin here, and then we'll come back if anybody's got any questions, comments, open mic, trending topics, whatever you want to talk about, 619-768-2945 is the number to call into.
In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks.